Hi guys, just to let you know, I have a promo of another podcast that I would love for you to listen to playing at the end of this episode, so please stay tuned until then.
Amelia Dyer was a murderer and she knew what she was doing. This was a calculated career plan that she'd embarked on and sustained over 30 years, come what may.
She wrote these adverts that were very cleverly crafted, saying that the child would be looked after and they'd been wanting a child for a long time and it would be loved, it would be a caring home. All these things were hitting exactly the right buttons for a young mum who, you know, was giving a child up.
Cold, heartless, unfeeling. Those kids meant nothing to her. It was just a means of getting money.
Hi M&Ms, welcome back to another episode of Murder and More. As always, I am your host, Kira. The Victorian era in the UK was the period of Queen Victoria's reign, from the 20th of June 1837 to the 22nd of January 1901, when she passed away at the impressive age of 81. Until Queen Elizabeth II surpassed her great-great-grandmother's record on the 9th of September 2015, Queen Victoria was the longest reigning British monarch. The Victorian era followed the Georgian era and preceded the Edwardian period. Medicine progressed significantly during Queen Victoria's reign, especially with the introduction of chloroform as a form of anaesthetic. Chloroform gained popularity in England when John Snow gave it to Queen Victoria during the birth of her eighth child. Antiseptic was also introduced to the British healthcare system in 1867, creating a much cleaner environment in hospitals. Due to the improvement in living standards over the era, the fertility rates increased significantly decade by decade. Whilst the living standards increased the number of women who were biologically able to have children, the rate of marriages increased, and the decrease in age of people getting married also contributed to the higher fertility rates. The lack of birth control was also instrumental in the increase in pregnancies. Amelia Dyer, originally Amelia Hobley, was born in either 1836, 1837, or 1838. Her date of birth has never been confirmed, but either way, she grew up in Victorian Britain. She lived in Pyle Marsh, a small town in Bristol, with her parents, Samuel Hobley, a master shoemaker, and her mother, Sarah Hobley, who suffered from mental illness. She had three brothers, Thomas, James, and William, and a sister, Anne. Amelia's upbringing wasn't a perfect one. Her mother had an infectious bacterial disease known as typhus, an infection that's typically spread through unsanitary conditions or areas that are overcrowded. It was common back in the 1800s, however now it's much less common. There are various types of typhus that's generally spread by body lice, fleas on rats, ticks, and harvest mites. Amelia's mother's case of typhus caused severe mental illness and triggered violent fits, which Amelia would always witness. Amelia cared for her mother a lot until her death in 1848. After Sarah's passing, Amelia moved in with her aunt in Bristol before taking up an apprenticeship at a corset maker. Her father passed away 11 years after her mother in 1859. When her father died, Thomas inherited the family shoemaking business, and somehow Amelia became estranged from both him and James. Once Amelia's parents were both deceased and she was estranged from her brothers, Amelia moved into Trinity Street in Bristol. Whilst living there, Amelia met and married George Thomas, who was 59 at the time, but falsified his age and told Amelia he was only 45. Amelia also deceived George and stated that she was 30 years old, when in fact she was actually only 24. As she grew up, Amelia learned to read and write and developed a love of literature and poetry, but once she married George, Amelia decided to train as a nurse. At some point, Amelia gave birth to a daughter, Ellen Thomas, which forced her to give up her nursing career. When George passed away in 1869, Amelia was desperate to make money. She made friends with the midwife, Ellen Dane, and through Ellen, Amelia found a much more lucrative way of making money. The 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act meant that men no longer had any financial obligation of illegitimate children, meaning that single mothers in Victoria Britain not only severely suffered financially as a direct result of this act, but they also faced the stigma there was at the time around bringing up an illegitimate child. This act and the social stigma around single mothers saw the development and rise of baby farming practice, where individuals would adopt unwanted children for a fee, which was either paid in a single lump sum or in regular instalments. Ellen introduced Amelia to the world of baby farming. Amelia found that she could permit women who had fallen pregnant illegitimately to lodge in her own home. A baby was typically put up for adoption by the mothers placing ads in newspapers, detailing their requirements for a kind, loving family to adopt their child. But instead of a loving family, a lot of these women's ads were answered by baby farmers. Whilst these baby farmers promised they'd give the child a loving home, what these babies actually experienced is sickening. Baby farming was a popular practice in Victorian Britain when contraception wasn't invented and single mothers were unable to feed, clothe, or keep a roof over their children's heads due to living in impoverished conditions. As well as a lack of contraception, social services also hadn't been formulated at the time, which contributed to baby farming originating in the first place. At the end of the day, baby farming must have seemed like the only option to mothers who were unable to provide a safe and stable home and life for their children. Abortions were illegal at the time, and backstreet abortions were associated with really high risks. Abandoning and murdering their children was also illegal, and the murder of an unwanted child even led to the death penalty. Baby farmers were paid under the understanding that they would provide a warm, loving, and secure home for the children under their care. But unfortunately, a lot of the time, baby farmers found it much easier to kill the children off. It wasn't just that it was easier to murder them, but it also yielded a quicker profit, as they didn't have to provide food or water for the children over a prolonged period of time. Farmers would often resort to starving the children, partly in order to save money, but also in an effort to induce death sooner. Babies that were noisy or distressed as a result of starvation could be sedated with the use of alcohol or opiates. Godfrey's cordial contained opiates, and this was a popular choice among baby farmers. Amelia placed her own ads whilst scouring the advertisements the young women had also placed in newspapers. When meeting with prospective clients, Amelia promised the women the baby would be cared for and loved. For a while, Amelia let the pregnant women stay in her home. She assisted with the delivery of the babies, and then the women entrusted her with the care of their children. Some women left the home without caring about what happened to their children, but others attempted to make contact with Amelia to see how the babies were doing, but it was very rare that Amelia would ever respond to these letters. Whilst they thought they were giving their children a better life in the hands of Amelia Dyer, we now know that those babies weren't safe right from the moment the young, unwed mothers walked through the front door. Once the women had given birth to their babies, Amelia would either farm them off for adoption or leave them to die as a result of malnutrition. From my research, articles seem to give varying descriptions. From what I can piece together, eventually Amelia ceased offering lodgings and instead just took the babies off the women. But I can't be 100% sure on that. Obviously, this is the 1800s, so I'm sure the information has been unintentionally changed over the years. Just 3 years after her elderly husband's death, Amelia married William Dyer, and together they had 2 children, Mary Ann and William Samuel. Some time after having the children, Amelia left William. It seems that throughout Amelia's baby farming career, she had taken up the practice of starving the children under her care until they died as a result of neglect and malnutrition. Although, eventually, Amelia became impatient and greedy, needing to pocket more of the money, and she felt like she was spending too much of it on food to keep the children alive. So, instead of inducing death slowly, Amelia changed tactics and began murdering the children she was entrusted with. In 1879, a doctor became suspicious of the amount of deaths Amelia had required certifying, but she wasn't charged with murder or manslaughter. Instead, Amelia was simply sentenced to 6 months hard labour for neglect. When a person was sentenced to hard labour, they were required to perform manual tasks all of their waking hours. These tasks could be working in a prison workshop, on a prison farm, or just moving rocks from a pile and creating a new pile. This sentence unfortunately meant that Amelia could continue killing unwanted babies as soon as she was released, for many more years to come. When Amelia was released from prison, she attempted to get back into her nursing career. However, it's alleged that Amelia's incarceration caused severe mental distress and resulted in her having multiple stays in mental institutions as a result. Although this appeared to coincide with occasions where it was useful for Amelia to disappear, maybe at times when she'd killed too many babies and was on the brink of getting caught if she didn't make herself disappear, a former asylum nurse, Amelia had the knowledge to be able to have a fairly comfortable stay in the institutions. It also appears that she developed an alcohol and opiate addiction early in her baby farming career, and it's suggested that these issues may have caused or at least participated in her mental illness. In 1880, when Amelia was released from prison, she continued killing babies that women handed over to her, but she changed tactics again, and instead of requiring a doctor to certify the infant's deaths, she began disposing of the bodies herself in order to avoid detection. In 1890, Amelia cared for the child of a governess, but when the governess returned to check on the welfare of her baby, she became suspicious and stripped the baby down. Her baby had had a birthmark on its hip, a birthmark that wasn't present on the baby Amelia presented her with. This led to prolonged suspicion by authorities, which caused Amelia to have, or at least pretend to have, a breakdown. As a result, Amelia attempted suicide by drinking 2 bottles of opiates. However, her abuse had resulted in a tolerance to opiums, and Amelia survived the attempt. Even though Amelia began disposing of the bodies herself by either burying them or throwing them in the River Thames, this still wouldn't prevent Amelia from getting caught, and once again, she came under the suspicion of not just the police, but parents returning to retrieve their children, children who were no doubt no longer alive. In order to escape suspicion, retain anonymity, and keep acquiring new business from unwed mothers, Amelia and her family frequently moved around to different cities and towns in order to remain under the radar. In 1893, at the age of 54, she was discharged from her final committal at the Somerset and Bath Lunatic Asylum, which is now more appropriately known as Mendip Hospital. In 1895, Amelia moved to Berkshire with Jane Smith, an associate she'd hired from a brief spell at a workhouse, her daughter Mary Ann, and her son-in-law Arthur Palmer. In January 1896, Evelina Marmon was a popular 25-year-old barmaid. She was a God-fearing farmer's daughter who had gone astray and left the farm for city life and had begun working as a barmaid in a local saloon. Evelina was blonde, busty, quick-witted, and really popular with the men who frequented the saloon. She gave birth to an illegitimate daughter, Doris, whose father remained unknown, in a boarding house in Cheltenham. Evelina loved her baby, but knew she wasn't capable of raising her on her own, so she put up an advertisement 2 months after Doris's birth, looking for a, quote, respectable woman to take a young child, end quote. Evelina's plan was to go back to work and hopefully in time be able to reclaim her daughter. Coincidentally, next to hers was an advert that read, quote, married couple with no family would adopt a healthy child, nice country home, terms £10, end quote. In today's currency, £10 would be £820.49. Evelina found the advert appealing and replied to it. A few days later, the poster of the advert, Mrs. Harding, responded to Evelina's letter, saying, quote, I should be glad to have a dear baby girl, one I could bring up and call my own. We are plain, homely people in fairly good circumstances. I don't want a child for money's sake, but the company and home comfort. I and my husband are dearly fond of children. I have no child of my own. A child with me will have a good home and a mother's love. End quote. Evelina attempted to bargain with Mrs. Harding on the price of Doris's adoption. She was living an impoverished life and struggling to survive. Whilst £10 is nothing to us now, back then it was a lot of money. All Evelina wanted was to spread the payments out into more affordable weekly payments, but Mrs. Harding insisted that she pay the one-off payment. Reluctantly, Evelina agreed to pay the £10, and Mrs. Harding came to Cheltenham the following week to collect Doris. When Evelina met Mrs. Harding, who was really Amelia Dyer, she was surprised about how much older the woman was than she expected, and stunned by her stocky build. Despite these slight concerns, Amelia was affectionate towards Doris, and Evelina's anxieties melted away. Along with her daughter, Evelina gave Amelia a cardboard box full of clothes and £10. Whilst she handed her daughter over, she was still distressed over giving her up, so Evelina accompanied Amelia to Cheltenham train station and then to Gloucester. At Gloucester's train station, Evelina cried as she watched the train take her beloved baby and returned where she was living in the boarding house in Cheltenham as a broken woman. A few days after relinquishing responsibility of her daughter, Evelina received a letter from Mrs. Harding reassuring her that all was well. Evelina replied to Mrs. Harding, but sadly she never received a further response. Little did Evelina know, she'd fallen victim to the social evil of baby farming and had handed her precious baby over to a vicious, manipulative, emotionless murderer. Little did she know that she'd never be able to retrieve Doris and bring her up the way she wanted. Amelia told Evelina that she was living in Reading, but in actual fact she took Doris back to her home in London, where she lived with her daughter Mary Ann. At the house, Amelia found white edging tape that was used in dressmaking in her work basket, wound the tape twice around the baby's neck and tied a knot. Heartbreakingly, Doris's death wouldn't have been a quick one. It's likely that the baby would have suffered for several minutes before passing away. Amelia later said of the babies she murdered, quote, I used to like to watch them with the tape around their neck, but it was soon all over with them, end quote. It's then suggested that Mary Ann helped her mother wrap the baby in a napkin and the pair searched through the cardboard box of clothes Evelina had given them. They kept some of the good clothes and the rest Amelia planned on sending to a pawnbroker. On Wednesday the 1st of April, 1896, 13-month-old Harry Simmons ended up under Amelia's care. This time, she didn't have any white edging tape to hand, so instead, she removed the length that she'd used to kill Doris from her neck and wrapped it around Harry's. She then watched as he fought for breath and eventually passed away. The following day, Amelia knew she had to dispose of the bodies. She placed them into a carpet bag, which is an open-top handbag made out of carpet, and added bricks to weigh the bag down. She then made her way to a secluded spot in Reading at Caversham Lock, a weir on the River Thames, and forced the bag through the railings into the river. However, it would quickly be discovered that this wasn't the first time Amelia had disposed of a body that way. Unbeknownst to her at the time she threw the bag into the river, another parcel had been retrieved from the river on the 30th of March 1896, just days before the murder of Doris Marmon and Harry Simmons. A bargeman in Reading found the parcel. Amelia's failure to put in enough bricks resulted in the parcel not sinking as she was hoping, allowing it to be found. The brown paper parcel contained the body of a baby girl, which would later be identified as 15-month-old Helena Fry. Detective Constable Anderson of the Reading Borough Police was able to use microscopic analysis in order to identify a name and an address, Pickett's Road, Lower Caversham, on the inside of the package. The name was Mrs. Thomas, and even though Amelia was Mrs. Dyer at the time, she had previously been Amelia Thomas when she married her first husband, George Thomas. It took police a while to link this name and address to Amelia Dyer, as she had moved around a fair bit since and changed her name several times. But finally, they were able to link Amelia to the name and address. But even though this incredible find led police to Amelia Dyer, they didn't yet have enough evidence to link her to a serious crime. For now, Amelia solely remained a person of interest in the case. In addition to the package containing a dead baby bearing Amelia's previous name and address, police gathered evidence from witnesses and Bristol police, which increased their concerns about her, so they put surveillance on Amelia's home. They realised that if Amelia suspected she was being watched by police, that she would abscond and they'd probably never catch her, at least not before she had the opportunity to murder other children. The police used a young woman as a decoy. They were hoping that she would be able to get in contact with Amelia to use her services. When Amelia opened her front door on the 3rd of April, she was expecting a young, pregnant girl. Instead, she was faced with detectives who wanted to search her house. Upon entering the house, the police were instantly hit with the awful smell of decomposition, or the human remains weren't recovered. They did find plenty of physical evidence, however, including the white edging tape that she'd used to kill Doris and Harry, and probably other children under her care. Telegrams recording the adoption arrangements, pawn tickets for children's clothing, receipts from advertisements she'd placed trying to garner new customers, and numerous letters from parents inquiring about the well-being of the children they'd willingly handed over to her were also found at the house. The police were able to calculate, I assume from records found at Amelia's home, that in the last few months alone, Amelia had been entrusted with at least 20 children. That's at least 20 young women who were desperate enough to put their babies up for adoption. 20 young women who met with Amelia thought she seemed like the kind, caring, loving woman she portrayed herself to be. 20 women who truly believed that Amelia would provide a good and loving upbringing for children that came into their lives at such inconvenient times. More than 20 women entrusted Amelia with their most precious possessions, and she destroyed that trust in the most heinous way. The fact that within a few months, Amelia Dyer had murdered at least 20 babies led to speculation that over the decades, she may have killed up to 400 babies, which would make her one of the most prolific serial killers ever. Amelia was arrested on the 4th of April and charged with murder, with her son-in-law Arthur Palmer being charged as an accessory. Over the following month, the River Thames was dredged and six more bodies were recovered, two of those being Amelia's last victims, Doris Mormon and Harry Simmons. Each of the babies they found had been strangled with the same white edging tape, which Amelia later told police was, quote, how you could tell it was one of mine, end quote. Just 11 days after Evelina Mormon entrusted Amelia with her daughter's life, she identified the remains found in the river as those of Doris. An inquest into the deaths took place in May, where it was revealed that they were unable to locate any evidence to suggest that Mary or Arthur Palmer were involved in the murders, and they were both cleared of any involvement. Amelia Dyer then wrote this confession, quote, Sir, you will kindly grant me the favour of presenting this to the magistrates on Saturday the 18th, instant I have made this statement out, for I may not have the opportunity then I must relieve my mind. I do know and feel my days are numbered on this planet, but I do feel it is an awful thing drawing innocent people into trouble. I do know I should have to answer before my Maker in heaven for the awful crimes I have committed, but as God Almighty is my judge in heaven and on earth, neither my daughter Mary Ann Palmer nor her husband Arthur Ernest Palmer, I do most solemnly declare, neither of them had anything to do with it. They never knew I contemplated doing such a wicked thing until it was too late. I am speaking the truth and nothing but the truth, as I hope to be forgiven. I, and I alone, must stand before my Maker in heaven to answer it all. Witness my hand, Amelia Dyer. End quote. Amelia Dyer appeared in front of Mr. Justice Hawkins at the Old Bailey on the 22nd of May, 1896, where she pleaded guilty to one count of murder, that of Doris Marmon. Several people, including Amelia's family and friends, testified against her, telling the court that they'd become increasingly suspicious about her behaviour and actions, and it was revealed that Amelia had come close to being caught on several occasions. A man who spoke to Amelia the day she pushed the carpet bag containing Doris and Harry's body through the railings into the River Thames also provided damning evidence. Amelia's own daughter gave graphic evidence that in the end secured her conviction. The only defence Amelia provided was one of insanity. However, the prosecution saw right through this charade and contended that her moments of mental instability were simply a distraction in order for her not to be caught. They said that both times Amelia was put into an asylum were times where she was extremely close to being caught or exposed for her crimes. The jury deliberated for a mere 4.5 minutes before finding Amelia Dyer guilty of murder. Although there were concerns about Amelia's sanity, ultimately the jury put more weight on just how heinous and appalling her crimes were. Mr. Justice Hawkins sentenced her to death, a practice which dates back as far as the 5th century and was abolished in 1965. Interestingly, if Amelia had committed her murders 100 years earlier, there's a chance she would have died as a result of beheading, with the last known beheading used as capital punishment taking place in 1747. Whilst the UK abolished beheading many centuries ago, it was only abolished in Norway in 1905 and Germany as recent as 1938. But what is more shocking to me is that the act of beheading is still a legal form of execution in Qatar and Yemen. Although there haven't been any reported executions taking place by this method in recent years, Amelia remained in her prison cell for only 3 weeks, but she was able to fill this time by filling 5 exercise books full of all of her confessions. Whilst Amelia was incarcerated, her daughter stood trial for murder, but the charges were eventually dropped. On the 10th of June, 1896, just 2 months after her final murders, Amelia Dyer was hanged by James Billington, assisted by William Wilkinson, at Newgate Prison. When asked if Amelia had anything to say, she said she didn't, and was promptly dropped from the scaffold at 9 a.m. Amelia was 57 years old at the time of her execution, making her the oldest woman to be executed since 1843. It is uncertain and will never be known exactly how many victims Amelia had. We already know that there was at least 20 just within a few months, so it stands to reason that there were many, many more that will more than likely never be discovered. Despite tougher adoption laws being put in place, baby farming didn't stop. In fact, 2 years after Amelia was hanged for her crimes, the families of her victims finally received justice. A baby was found in a parcel on a railway carriage in Devon. The baby, who thankfully survived being abandoned, was the daughter of Julie Hall, a widow who gave her daughter to a woman by the name of Mrs. Stewart for £12. It's believed that Mrs. Stewart was in fact Mary Ann, Amelia Dyer's own daughter. It's impossible to even begin to imagine the extent of the pain, suffering and heartbreak Amelia inflicted on the children she was supposed to love and care for and their families. Families who were completely unaware of the monster they were trusting to protect their babies from harm. The agony the mothers who gave up their children must have suffered throughout their lives is unimaginable, lives that I'm sure were governed by anguish and torment. Eventually, the practice of baby farming ceased as a result of tougher laws being brought in. The Infant Life Protection Act of 1897 and the 1908 Children's Act required notification to local authorities within 48 hours of a change of custody or death of a child under the age of 7. These acts also empowered authorities to actively seek out baby farmers and remove children they suspected were being abused. The Children's Act also redefined improper care of children, stating, quote, "No infant could be kept in a home that was so unfit and so overcrowded as to endanger its health, and no infant could be kept by an unfit nurse who threatened, by neglect or abuse, its proper care and maintenance," end quote. The real abolishment of baby farming came, however, when the government implemented proper regulations for fostering and adopting children that were unable to be cared for by their mothers. Finally, women could admit that they didn't have the means to provide the child with the life they deserved and were able to give them up without scrutiny and in the knowledge that the child would be placed into a safe environment. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.
Dumb and Busted has been called, quote, one of America's greatest treasures by 3 out of 3 hosts of the show.
Dumb and Busted is a weekly true crime comedy podcast with stories of exceptionally smart and insanely dumb crimes. Comedian Hunter Donaldson has hailed it as the greatest thing to come out of Portland since comedian Hunter Donaldson, who is me, also a host of the show.
Podcasters Allison Copeland and Hannah Ether praised Dumb and Busted as, quote, found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Just more rave reviews from two other people who host the show.
Catch us every Thursday and follow us at Dumb and Busted on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Crime you later!